Group meeting, Sunday, 18th April, 1982. Last month, we dealt or tried to deal with a matter of very great importance. I say tried to deal because it is one of the deepest things in connection with living the religious life. You remember what the subject matter was? It was in connection with the silence. It is a matter of extreme importance because we human beings hope for or strive to live in such a manner that we may realize immortality after we are dead. Immortality doesn't belong to any of us after we are dead. What dies is the existential being, the psychophysical organism. And that organism dies completely and utterly. The whole of the psyche, the whole of the body, completely dies. And that which composed the psychophysical organism just goes back into the universal stock. It is very, very difficult for us to give up the idea that there will be anything for us afterwards, in the hereafter, as we call it. The I am I misconception which we hold so dearly, the I am I in the sense of an identifiable entity which is permanent, which will last through all time. All that we understand about immortality or think we understand about immortality is just wishful thinking, a longing for this entity, whatever it may be, to continue through all time. Now you see, time, space, matter, and the total universe is entirely perishable. The total universe, including human beings as such. This is a terrible thing to realize, to begin to see. We find it extremely difficult to let go of our ego sense. Extremely difficult. And so we crave for a personal immortality. Now, one has to realize that our conception of self, when we talk about people in the world use phrases like my Atma, my eternal soul, my immortal spirit. They are just talking wishfully out of their ignorance. There is immortality, but not in terms of the temporal continuance forever and ever of an identifiable entity. Now, this is extremely difficult to grasp. One may begin to sense it, begin to see it, and there are terrible dangers attached to saying such things, writing such things, accepting or believing such things. Terrible dangers, because you know what people in the world are like. They are the slaves of their pleasure drive, their ambitions, their wish fulfillments, and all sorts of illusions, delusions, and follies. They are the slaves of it. and to put it to them that after death the existential being is completely dead and there's no survival of an I am I, they immediately feel, well then, I'll eat, drink and be merry and have a good time whilst I'm here, and I don't care how. People have asked me this sort of question, you see, last year as well as year before last at the Buddhist summer school. Well, the only thing that I can tell them is, try it out and see. Eat, drink, be merry, and see what happens to you. Now, how are we to look at this? How can we sort of begin to understand this? When we say I, the majority of human beings in the world think of themselves as just the body. This is me. Yes, it is me, in the existential sense only. I am the body, in the existential sense. Others who are educated, who are cultured, who have been conditioned by parents, by teachers, by priests, by their reading of religion and so forth, and by the writings of the greatest of philosophers and theologians and so forth, they all assert the immortality of the soul. And so forth, you see. All right. What is the soul? People don't know. People will say, oh, it's my mind. It's my mind, notice, they say. Others will say it is a spark of the divine. Those who think and feel in theistic terms. It's a spark of the divine. And if you ask them, what is the divine, of which you have a spark? Oh, the divine is the absolute, the eternal, the immortal being. Now you see, the immortal being is a self-contradictory term. What we call a being comes into existence, is born, lives, and dies inevitably. Any entity, any state, is something which belongs to the realm of mortality. It perishes. It comes to an end. One may say, oh, well, but that end is a transformation into something rich and strange and immortal. And they identify their own self with that postulated immortal entity as such. But they forget that in actual fact, what they have in mind is nothing which is immortal, but one or other of the perishable elements which composes the whole of the psychophysical being. You know how all over the world, as a matter of fact, there is the sort of teaching that a person, the person whom we see and talk to and deal with, is a psychophysical, a body-mind creature. And in if you take the analysis of the word mind in the Buddhist manner, you will find that the term nama rupa is presented as shape, form, appearance, which is generally associated only with the body, which I think is rather short-sighted, because rupa, the form, can be a mental form. All our thoughts, all our feelings, they take shape and form. So they have rupa, you see, but of a nature which is not solid, liquid or gaseous. The body, of course, has this, its solid part, its liquid part, its gaseous part, and so forth. Now they'll acknowledge that, yes, this perishes, but something carries on, they'll say. Then they'll go to feelings, vedana, and they'll go to sanya, perceptions, and sankhara, the various mental conformations. Confections is one of the words which the early scholars used, and there is a good deal in that terminology. Confections for the sankhara, the mental sort of patterns which people have in mind. And finally, vijnana, discriminative consciousness. Now the Buddha expressly taught that every one of these elements which composes the person whom you see alive in front of you, you see, all those elements completely perish. Not one of them is amata, without death, deathless. And it's very interesting, the Buddha never had a word for immortality, nor did the Upanishads or the Hindus. The Hindus called it amrita. This comes afterwards through Greek influences and so on, the nectar, as they call it, of immortality and so forth, you see. The not deathness. And the Buddha declares after the enlightenment, when he goes to the five who were with him in the early days, trying to realize the deathless state. That was their objective. They had noticed that all this dies. Is there a deathless state? And the Buddha, after the enlightenment, says, yes, there is a deathless state. You see, the deathless has been found. He didn't say immortal, and he didn't say in that first sermon what exactly is meant by the deathless. But he did teach continuously that all the elements which compose the existential being, the psychophysical, the nama-rupa creature, is perishable. All of it is completely perishable. Now, if any of us will look, assuming that we are capable of looking absolutely unbiasedly, and looking absolutely clearly into what is in our own deepest perceptions with regard to what we think may be that identifiable entity which is permanent, you see, we will find that in actual fact it is always associated with one or other of the khandhas. The constituents, khandhas means the constituents of the psychophysical being. One or other of those constituents. There are some who will affirm positively, oh no, my immortal self is the Atma, the Atta, or the Pali word, the Atta. You see, it is that. It is a statement. It is an arbitrary statement, but they have no real consciousness of the Atta. Now, why do I say that? When any one of us is really fully conscious of anything, then in our everyday life of thought and feeling, of speech and action, that consciousness clearly expresses itself. And it expresses itself without the brain needing to know that I am conscious in this way and I am expressing myself in this way. Doesn't need that brain knowledge, you see. the full consciousness of anything is also action. It is actually manifest as a living process. Take, I don't know whether I said this last time, it can bear repetition. I am born, an infant, just born, and for some weeks or months I can only make involuntary movements. I have no other power of movement or action. Then comes the next stage when I begin to crawl. Then comes the next stage when I begin to toddle, helped by mum or dad or somebody and so forth. And then comes the next stage when I can walk without help. Then comes the final stage when the body can run freely. Now, when the body is running freely, as it is running, does it say, oh, I've got to put my left foot forward this time and lift my right foot and bring it forward again and so forth and take care that I balance myself and so forth? There is no brain activity, but the activity of the body is whole and complete in the process of running. That action is the complete ultimate expression of the consciousness of movement, of running with the body. Now, do you get that clearly? So that people say, when you can run, you just run without having to think about it. They are correct in saying that. You don't have to think about it. But some people will say that you are quite unconscious about it. You are not unconscious. You are totally, completely conscious about it. The whole body is completely conscious of what it is doing. They talk of the automatic processes of the body, you see, digestion and all the rest of it. I would say that all those processes which just go on naturally and spontaneously without needing the activity of memory or thought or calculation or anything, they all express the completeness of consciousness of what is being done bodily. You see? So now, when there is complete and total consciousness, then something happens. The Buddha pointed out clearly that our consciousness, as it functions in our existential being, vijnana, discriminative consciousness, is something which perishes. There's a very long discourse in the Majjhima Nikaya where Sati, the fisherman, holds the idea, the fisherman's son, holds the idea that vijnana carries on. Vijnana never carries on and comes into incarnation in another body and so forth. Nothing of the sort. Don't ask, then what carries on and reincarnates? There is no such thing as reincarnation as the popular view, according to the popular view held. You see, now consider carefully. This is terribly heretical, but I know that the whole of India would like to throw a stone at my head and finish with that awful chatterer. But we'll leave that aside for the moment. Now, consider carefully. Vijnana is discriminative consciousness. What does vijnana do? What does discriminative consciousness do? Its activity is an analytical activity, and in every analysis you separate, don't you? Just as in chemical analysis, you separate out this, that and the other and discover all the different elements which compose this substance or whatever the subject of inquiry is. You see, you analyze, you dissect, you separate, you split up the wholeness, you fragment it. By splitting up the wholeness and examining each part as if it existed in its own rights, you make your scientific statement. And scientifically speaking, up till nowadays, is an accurate statement. But now science itself has undergone a tremendous change in all this, you see. So vijnana is the separator. It is our vijnana helped to develop by those around us, our parents, our teachers, our friends, other people, whoever they may be, which makes us separate out. You, he, she, me, etc. So the idea of abstracting this out of the totality takes root in us. See, we abstract our individual selves. I'm using the word self in the ordinary English meaning of the word, you see, a psychophysical organism, John Smith, you see, I'm using it in that sense. It makes us abstract our individual selves out of the totality of the whole of humanity, which is part, which must not be abstracted out of the whole of the earth, the planet, the whole system, the entire manifested universe. Now you see, our idea of self then is an abstraction, is something which is cut off from the whole. That is why we are unholy. Honestly, I mean, meditate very deeply on this. I say meditate, not just think about it. You'll have to start by just thinking. But let your thinking process be very quiet, peaceful. Let the mind just brood over the idea to start with. It has to be an idea to start with. Let the mind just brood over the idea like a hen broods over the egg, and ultimately there comes a chicken. A chick. Isn't that so? Now, if the mind, if the brain is capable of getting quiet with this brooding process, an extraordinary change will take place. This vijnana, which abstracts this particular person out of the totality, will lose its capacity to abstract the personal self out of the totality. You see, we see with our eyes, and whatever we see, we say that thing, that person, other than this person. Don't we? That is how we see. We hear that person, that bird, and so on, the sound of the wind through the trees, and all the rest of it. So our senses all cooperate in producing this abstraction, in tearing out something out of the one total reality, out of the whole. This is what our senses do. This is where we have to beware of the senses. Since we are existential beings who function on this planet, which is all existential, you see, the existentiality necessitates this abstracting process to take place. Otherwise, the next bus will run over me if I don't abstract myself and get out of the way. You see, that thing and me. But this abstracted thing in consciousness separates out self from the not-self. And here is the root of all evil and the entire illness of the whole human race. I, and the not I. The not I is the totality. I am another totality within myself, abstracted. I am the one and only. And 4,000 million of us on the globe are stupid enough to try and make a happy and harmonious human world, all abstracting ourselves from the others. If we abstract ourselves from all others, we naturally raise up our own particular interests, ideas, beliefs, and so forth, and we will quarrel and fight with others who have different ideas, beliefs, and conceptions, and so forth. You see? So this vijnana, helped by the sense activities, is the producer of this I am I concept, which is a misconception. A total misconception. Because whatsoever is, from an atom to a galaxy, from a virus to a perfected holy one, is in complete and total relationship with the entire universe. I say is in relationship. I should not deny its relationship. But because the relationship is an actuality, a basic actuality, underlying the entire universal process of countless separate particulars. Now, once we begin to see this, we find that the consciousness, which is completely limited, imprisoned in terms of the consciousness which expresses itself as myself and the not-self, the rest of the world, you see, that undergoes a tremendous change. And with that change, one wakes up, one begins to wake up to the reality which we can only talk of in dualistic terms. Because all talking, all language, and all conceptions, therefore, because language expresses conceptions, or can only be in dualistic terms. This is the unfortunate part of talking, you see, or of writing. We will begin to wake up to the unitary wholeness of the totality. The unitary wholeness. They won't be mere words any longer. You will begin to be conscious of it, you see. And that process of consciousness will culminate in total absolute consciousness, the pure consciousness of this unitary wholeness, and it will function as such, just as the toddler ultimately runs and the whole body functions that way. You see? We will begin to wake up to the actuality of infinity, eternity, and immortality. Now, why do I associate all three like that? This doesn't mean that infinity is this, eternity is that, and immortality is that. That is again sort of separating out in thought. Now the brain will perform all sorts of tricks, trying to prevent us from seeing the reality. This brain is an awful Mephistopheles, beware of it. But also, without it, there is no means of waking up. By sending the deluded brain completely to sleep, the deluded brain goes completely to sleep, but by that process, consciousness fully wakes up, and mind in its grand reality functions through you for the first time. Why do I then associate these three things together? If one begins to be conscious of this infinity and this eternity, you see, then one's consciousness frees itself from being limited to our ordinary mode of consciousness, where every thought and feeling, word and action begins, it uprises, it proceeds, it lives its life, and then it dies. It frees itself from that limitation. And by the freeing itself from that limitation, what we commonly call birth, death, or life, death, if you like, that is why I have, The Heart of Religion was written, I discarded that life-death pulse and called it the life, other life pulse, is a oneness all the time. It's one. Life and death are not separate. Where will you draw the line if your consciousness becomes total? Because the fact of the world process is the fact of change, of a transformation taking place. But where will you draw your lines if your consciousness is so complete and total that you are omniscient actually, consciously, you see? Not omniscient in any brain knowledgeable sense. This is an extraordinary thing altogether. You become conscious of that, of the actual change taking place. You don't see it as a change taking place there or just inside yourself, but you see that change in its totality. You are conscious of that change in its totality. I have to use words like see or touch or hear. These are all unfortunate. They are all unfortunate where enlightening us is concerned. They are just shadows of truth. But there you are. This is what actually happens. So when that happens, since there is no beginning, no birth, no proceeding, just living through a process ruled by our time sense, and no ending, no death, no destruction at the end, you see, so to say, then where is mortality? That's your deathless consciousness. When the perfected Holy One enters into that meditative state, the pure meditative state, or as in theistic mysticism, the perfect contemplative state, the culmination of the contemplative state, there is no death following birth in the process of that contemplation. And that contemplation, please do remember, this has never been properly put out, even by the greatest of the Christian mystics, as far as I'm aware. It has never been put out. This contemplative state is not a contemplative state in the sense of a brain contemplating, a brain thinking thoughts. It is an activity of consciousness in its transcendent reality. The meditative state is the activity of consciousness in its own, at its own transcendent level. Level is a bad word because it implies differences. In its own transcendent reality, you see. The absolute consciousness. It was that sort of thing which a person like Jesus knew when he said, not a sparrow falleth to the ground, but my Father in heaven knoweth it. The Father in heaven, Abba. The Son of the unknown. That which emerged out of the unknown and the unknowable by the brain or by any of our of what we call knowing. What we call knowing just doesn't exist at that level at all. Just doesn't exist. It is this transcendent being conscious. You see? And that state is a state which has spelled the complete silence, the silencing of the entire existential functioning and the awareness of that existential functioning. You have, whilst living existentially in the realm of mortality, you have realized, made real, immortality. Wait a minute, that's not the correct way to put it. It's not that you have realized immortality, but immortality is realized through you by the infinite eternal. You know, it's a tiny, tiny little bit like this. You know, Edison invented the electric light. And you know, he spent 5 days and four nights without sleep, without stopping, working, till at last the bulb lit without the filament breaking and electric light flooded the room. It's a little bit like that. So now, that state is entirely silent. There is no noise, there is no disturbance in it. There is no thought whatsoever taking place there, there is no feeling. Intellectual activity as we know it, emotional activity, the feeling nature, the perceiving nature, they are all in slumber. But it is a slumber which is entirely conscious, fully awake, without the disturbance of the ordinary waking state. These are quite extraordinary things. So now, what happens then when the existential being dies? Well, the psychophysical organism dies completely. It is the one act which no man can avoid performing completely and fully. Jim smiles, quite rightly. No one can stop performing that act completely and fully. Then the person says, but good gracious, are you saying therefore that I am completely annihilated? Not annihilated. Look, how does the existential come into being? We have to start off, after all, with some creative energy. The existential is a manifestation, isn't it? All right, the primordial creative energy and pure or absolute consciousness undergo, I have mentioned this before, you remember, undergo differentiation in terms of energy, proliferation in terms of consciousness. And the two, both of them intertwine in the process. As energy differentiates and consciousness proliferates simultaneously, then all manifestation, and with manifestation, the separation, the separateness comes into being. You see? So, the manifestation, the separateness, is transcendence embodied. Transcendence has limited itself. And by its own self-limitation, the entire cosmos comes into being. But with the coming into being of the cosmos, which is the unitary wholeness, becomes the multitudinous variety, the infinitely multitudinous variety becomes that, you see. All right, but that multitudinous variety coming into being means that this primordial creative energy is differentiated, split up, and the consciousness is imprisoned. It gets more and more imprisoned till it comes right to the ultimate physical solid condition, the solid state. Then comes the reverse activity in the universal process. Scientists have actually ventured to suggest a timetable for eternity, as they call it, of the universe. And they suggest that in about 10 to the power 2,000 years, that's one with 2,000 noughts after it for the number of years, the final radiation will take place and the whole manifested universe will go out with a sort of a hiss. And there'll be eternal silence, the eternal void. I've got an article there in the Science Digest where it is written. It's most fascinating to read it. We must not take these figures and facts as absolute truth or anything. That is what seems to be the fate of the universe. So that manifestation will disappear altogether. But what happens thereby? The eternal, the infinite, which constricted itself, is now once more just itself. So there is no annihilation. There is a complete transmutation. You take a hydrogen nucleus and another hydrogen nucleus, which means one proton and another proton, and the destruction of the two means the production of a helium nucleus, the next stage. And this goes on until you come to the heavier elements and you end up with iron. And the other heavy elements of the universe, they undergo the process of coming down to iron through radiation. So the ultimate of the manifested universe is that sort of ultimate, you see. So that is looking at it purely from the manifested side, which is the material side of things. But in terms of absolute consciousness, pure consciousness, and of the primordial creative energy, that remains itself. You know, there's in this connection, there is just a paragraph in chapter 14 of The Heart of Religion. Out of the infinite, I emerge. I know not how. But the infinite is not lessened by my emergence. When I die, the infinite takes me back into itself, but the infinite is not increased thereby. In 70 or 80, well, it'll have to be more than 80 years because I'm practically that now, you see. Within those 80 years, in the manifested universe, there's a little bit of noise named Firoz Mehta, you see. And it goes off. I hope I don't hiss when I go off like the universe is supposed to hiss, you see. I'd rather give the universe a kiss instead of hissing at it. And the infinite is the infinite. If one can begin to sort of sense that inwardly, a sense of transcendence wakes up in you. And then you know, you are conscious, even in a tiny degree, really conscious of the meaning of God is eternal God. When one is like that, then what one does is true yoga, but not till then, so to say. Because it is true yoga, because those elements which obstruct the true yogic life, the life of the true religia, all the elements which obstruct are out. The fundamental, indispensable basis is the living of the moralities. There's no getting away from that. And in the process of the living of the moralities, one has to practice silence. You know, in the Varaha Upanishad, I think it is reiterated 3 times. Practice silence. Practice silence. And that silence becomes so intense that you hear the music of the spheres. These are phrases. You hear nothing at all with your ears, you see. You see the light of lights and so forth. But those are just human, subhuman phrases in our different languages to express, to attempt to suggest the inexpressible. But if any one individual purifies himself that way, then he becomes like the sun, spreading light and life and warmth to the world on which the sun shines. And as one may put it, you, the existential being, here and now, having some glimmering of true consciousness of the immortal, are a blessing to the world in which you live.